You're listening to the Screaming Pods Network.
Suburbs are supposed to be as this idyllic place that you go to live.
I think we should move.
You know, you have your house and you have your land and you stay there, and it's a great place to retire to. It's a great place to raise a family. That's what the suburbs are supposed to be. But in fact, in the last 20 years or so, the suburbs have become this place where anything can happen.
Art's got a gun.
You have these neighbors that no one knows what they're up to.
Saw them in the backyard. Digging.
Kind of like grave diggers.
They could be, you know, anything from insomniacs who are lazy.
No one goes in, no one comes out.
Or, you know, suburban psycho killers who have a, you know, a death factory in their basement.
Down.
They're grim folks. They got a bleak house. I don't know, you know, what's going on in it. You know, there's a lot of weird stuff going on. Kid comes out in a car and dumps his trash in a can at night and beats it with a hoe. What is that? That ain't normal. People in neighborhoods, they don't want this going on in the neighborhood.
I've never seen that. I've never seen anybody drive their garbage down to the street and then bang the hell out of it with a stick on. I've never seen that.
They just revert back to behavior that is, I think, normally confined to high school boys.
Wait, unconscious chanting. You're chanting.
I want to kill everyone. Satan is good. Satan is our pal.
Or even pre-high school.
Ray, this is Walter.
No!
Ray.
You know, hopefully they've all done our jobs well enough, so this movie will be funny enough to be a comedy.
Oh! Oh!
At the same time, bizarre enough to be some other kind of movie.
I'm going over the fence.
Fire! Oh, Jesus!
I'm not coming back till I find a dead body.
Carol!
Knocks off an old man in my neighborhood and gets away with it.
Welcome to another episode of Just the Discs. My name is Brian Sauer. This is my podcast about Blu-rays. I've got my good friend John Cribbs returning to talk Joe Dante. He was with me on the matinee episode, and he's back for the burbs. John, thank you for coming back.
Thank you. That kid next door is a meatball. Just want to throw that out there.
Oh, my God. Dude, every single line. I don't think that Dern has a line in this movie that's not one for the ages. I really don't think there's anything.
Hey, man, piss off, Ricky.
Yo,
get this lame-o out of your yard.
Get out of my yard, lame-o.
So many great lines, and I mean Dern. What can you say about Rumsfeld? You know, Jesus, what a character! What a perfect casting! I mean, every moment he's on screen is just, I love it.
Yeah,
can't get
enough. Like I said in the last episode, I don't really dedicate entire episodes to a single movie, but Joe Dante is and always will be the exception to the rule. And I think, John, you feel the same way I do about this movie in that I want to say it's your favorite Dante. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and it's my favorite too. And there's just something about it, and it's great to see it having come around. I mean, not that it was ever... No, I mean, I think to Joe, even watching these extras, you still get a sense that he's not baffled, but, you know, kind of bemused by the fact that it's one of his most popular films. Like, he seems to indicate that it basically now has become, he's the Gremlins guy and the Burbs guy, like those two, which I never necessarily thought would be the case.
Yeah, it's funny to think that this one was ever not beloved by people, you know,
yeah.
It's just... been absolutely great to see it have this kind of turnaround, because from when I saw it when it first came to video when I was 10, 11 years old, I knew something special. I mean, to me, it seemed like as important as a Spielberg movie or, you know, any of the other huge blockbusters coming out at the time. And to find out afterwards that it just wasn't getting that kind of love. It's the same as Matinee. I just couldn't believe that more people weren't talking about this movie, quoting it left and right to their friends like I was. And it's great now that it's got, you know, a following for sure.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
that's become like his other movie.
I just, that was interesting. That was the first time I'd heard that specifically. I mean, I knew it was among his most popular, but that it was second behind Gremlins was pleasing for me. But yeah, what, it's easily his most quotable movie. I can't think of another movie he's done that's more quotable than this.
Thermostat on a home furnace, is that supposed to go to 5,000 degrees, you think?
I can have entire conversations with Christopher Funderburg where we only talk in burbs language. I mean, it's...
that is great.
And our friend Eric Frender as well, who also works on the Pink Smoke with us, is a huge Burbs fan. And yeah, it's, we love it. And we put together a list of our favorite moments and published it just all, as it was on the site, just to say, there's so many things to love about this movie. You know?
Yeah, I think here's a moment where people should go and check out that list at the Pink Smoke. But do you have a few highlights from that? Because I basically have my notes. I was telling you off record that my notes are basically like, things I love about the Burbs and then the special features. So what are some of the highlights from that list? I know it was extensive, that list.
I want to be careful not to like geek out too much, you know, in this episode, because it literally can just get pulled down into me like quoting my favorite moments from the movie. It could be exactly that, but there are just so many amazing, I mean, Joe Dante moments in this film. The pan shot behind Hans where he first comes out onto the porch, where you get to see all the neighbors staring at him and you get the scope of the whole street.
Hey, one of the Hans came out of the cave.
Just tells you the story of that movie right there.
You got that great Jerry Goldsmith organ music playing. That's really great there.
Oh, the Goldsmith score is phenomenal. It's maybe, I don't know, man, Gremlins is such a great score, but this might be my favorite Goldsmith collaboration with Dante. I think it's fantastic.
I think you're right.
Yeah, it's beautiful. The chimes and the, oh, it's great. The organ, it's terrific. I mean, it has two great food-related transitions. One is where... Ray's son and Art are staring at each other.
Oh, I love that.
Says, what are they doing? Digging. And then it cuts to them eating and taking a bite at the same time. That side shot.
What were they doing, honey?
Digging.
Kind of like grave diggers?
Maybe.
All right, that's enough of this conversation.
It's phenomenal.
That's great.
And then when Art's got the cookies in Walt's house, and Corey Feldman opens the door, Ricky Butler opens the door and smashes the plate right at that high tense moment where Rumsfeld says, "You're here in a big hurry." Just phenomenal, just amazing editing on that shot.
That's great.
But like I said, oh my God, Art calls him Garbies. I could talk forever about
Wait, when does he call him Garbies? What is that?
When he's running towards him initially when they're picking up the trash and he goes, "Garbies, Garbies, wait."
Wait, hold it, Garbies! Garbage man! Hold on a minute!
Wait
a sec! Wait, hold it! Hold, what are you doing?
I don't miss Garbies all this time. Oh my God. And then we talked about it a little bit on the Patreon episode for the Pink Smoke, but the Picardo Dick Miller duo as the Garbage Man is one of my favorite instances of both of those character actors as part of the Joe Dante stable. Those two together in this movie, man, I love them. I love seeing them like that.
This seminar could change your life, Vic. The man is a great healer.
And I'm a great bowler. And Wednesday night, we're taking on Roselli Plumbing.
You really should expose yourself to this guy, Vic. He understands paraphysical forces, the healing capabilities of crystals, and the laying on of hands.
You want to try laying on some hands?
I wrote a script once set partly in a bowling alley, and I had the match between Roselli Plumbing and the Garbage Men as part of it, just as a reference to that, to Dick Miller, my love of Dick Miller.
Oh my God, that is fantastic. That is fantastic.
We should put that out there because, yeah, that scene is just legendary. Those two guys are so funny together. Such great chemistry. You just wish that they had done more together. They would have appeared in more scenes in Dante movies. You know,
they should have had their own buddy movie. That would have been amazing. Picardo and him together. Oh, my God. I remember hearing just recently on the Shockwaves podcast, Rob G was talking about an outtake that he thinks exists as part of the That Guy Dick Miller documentary, where basically Dick, and I'm going to see if I can find a clip of it. I may not be able to, but basically Dick Miller is, they're getting ready for a take, and Dick Miller and Corey Feldman are in a scene together, and he says something like,
"What else could you do with those hoes?
Shut the fuck up, kid. We're trying to do some acting."
Ready!
I can't even imagine Dick Miller struggling with Corey Feldman at that, especially at that point that Corey was at, you know, I mean.
I was pretty reckless by that point. I know that I was like smoking weed on the set. Like I remember being in my trailer and I was friends with Sam Kinison, the comedian. Sure, I'd open the door and there'd just be weed bellowing out of it.
He was a smart ass kid.
I don't have a problem. I'm good. I'm fine. What are you talking about?
Yeah. It seems like a difficult time.
Yeah,
to say the least.
It comes up a few times on this new disc and the extras, but man, just Dick Miller just coming on set and being Dick Miller, and and the idea that they had this, you know, Universal lot set with Dick Miller, Brother Theodore, Bruce Dern, Carrie Fisher, Wendy Shaw, all on one set is just like, oh my God.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much amazing stuff, and it was really, I don't know, not therapeutic isn't the right word, but certainly enlightening and wonderful to go through these extras. Well, before we get to the extras, let me just run down a few more from my list of things I love. I love, and I'm sure you do too, and actually several people in the special features comment on it, the opening shot from the Universal logo that zooms down to the earth and lands in the cul-de-sac is absolutely brilliant.
Gorgeous.
What a way to start, you know, so memorable. Nobody had ever done that before, surprisingly, and I'm like, wow, Joe, you nailed it, man. That's just brilliant.
Hi, I'm Ty West, and you're watching Trailers from Hell. We're going to take a look at The Burbs. I don't know if this is my favorite. It might be. There's a lot of them that are tied for my favorite, but this one I think is certainly the one I've seen the most. And I also had a very poignant experience seeing this in the movie theater when the opening of the film starts with a shot of the Universal logo and the camera goes into the globe, and it blew my mind. And to this day, I'm still very excited by that special effect, but it was something that, as a kid, when I saw the movie, I'd never seen that. I'd never seen a logo sort of absorb into the movie before, and that was a really fascinating. It just made me think outside of the box.
It's great. It makes me think of a little bit later, Peter Jackson in The Frighteners opening with starting above the house and then zooming into the house to find, you know, Dee Wallace as she's running around. It's, you know, another really beautiful opening, but it doesn't start from space and go into the world, you know, into the world and find this tiny cul-de-sac that the whole film is going to be set in. So not quite as ambitious, but yeah, I get very few opening shots I think are quite as perfect.
Well, and it's such a Joe thing to do. I mean, not only does he start with if you watch, the Universal logo is kind of animated because they have to, I think, in order to do, in terms of the special effects, it wasn't CG. They had to do it another way. So you got whatever comp they're doing. But it looks a little different. It looks animated, which is great because obviously we know Joe is a big animation fan, and that it can be felt through this movie. I was, you know, the other thing I was thinking was I was seeing Brother Theodore in this movie, and he reminds me of a Looney Tunes character in the way that his mouth, he has a certain,
you know
what I'm talking about? With his jaw, when his jaw is at rest, especially when he's got his grumpy face on, he looks like a grumpy character from a Looney Tunes cartoon, which is great.
He does, doesn't he? He looks like a mad scientist who'd be in like a Bugs Bunny cartoon or something, like who released Gossamer on him, you know?
Oh my God.
Has that kind of curmudgeon-y grumpiness that like a straight character, a straight villain would have in that. That's a great observation. You know, I think the most Looney Tunes moment, most Looney Tunes shot possibly of all Dante's career, even in his Looney Tunes movie, might be after Art has fallen through the shed.
Yes.
And there's that shot through it of his, the form of his body.
It's such a throwaway, and you could totally miss it. You could just be like, oh, it's a hole in the roof. But if you look, it is the Art silhouette through the roof, which is great. Such a great touch, you know? And I don't know. There's so many things that Joe does. And I know some of it was scripted, especially having listened to the commentary, but I just feel like he brings so many extra little bits that you probably aren't even going to pick up the first time you see the movie. And when you're at a point where you and I are at, where you're watching it, you know, for the 60th time, I mean, who knows how many times we've seen this movie, I'm still noticing things, you know, especially as
Absolutely.
The transfers have gotten better, I'm noticing things more and more.
Everything that I get, once it's handed to me, sort of goes through the filter. And what comes out the other end has been up to now, more or less, a Joe Dante movie. And I can't quite explain how that works, but there is a certain consistency to the movies. I mean, I'm a big cartoon fan, so the movies are often very cartoon-like. And I'm a big Mad Magazine fan, so they're very satirical. And, you know, I like fantasy movies, and so there's always an element somewhere, whether it deserves to be in there or not, of fantasy, like this one has a dream sequence in it, which was actually... I'm not comparing it to the one in Spellbound, but it used to be longer, and it had some pretty cool things in it, but it really did sort of stop the story, so we had to take them out.
Yeah, the 2K transfer here looks fantastic. Just in that early shot where Ray comes and stands on the property line looking at the house in the first scene, you can see the street light on him. That orange really pops. That's the first time I've ever noticed that in that shot, you know. So yeah, it's definitely nice to see a cleaned up version available on Blu-ray.
Yeah, and again, I'm sort of bleeding into the extras a little bit, but there's an interview with the production designer, or some of that comes out in the documentary, where they're talking about the cartoonishness of this fantasy world that Joe wants to create, and how the colors are very heightened, you know, and, you know, the outfits that Rick Dukeman wears, especially, but all the characters really have a certain heightened color palette that I hadn't even really thought about. But certainly when you see a nice transfer of the movie, you start to get a better sense of it, more or less.
And the dream sequence too looks gorgeous with all those very stylistic lighting in that scene.
Yeah.
Looks great. All those reds and blues and that. Yeah, it looks phenomenal.
Yeah, that's a great... That's one of the things I do love about the movie. The dream sequence is great. That was, I think for me, I saw this in the theater and I remember really liking it, but I don't think I had seen... I had seen some horror movies, but not a lot. I think I was yet to see, like, Evil Dead 2 and some of the formative stuff that I saw in high school that really pushed me headlong into the genre. I mean, I'd seen the occasional Friday the 13th and been freaked out by it, but I hadn't fully, I don't think, embraced horror. And so having that sort of crossover dream sequence, which is really well done and funny, but still kind of creepy. I always love the way that Brother Theodore says, "Mind your own business." And then he raises the dagger and Tom Hanks is like, "Okay." He's like, "I get it, you know." Anyway, that whole sequence is just so well done. I mean, even down to like the picture frame of Tom Hanks and his family, which is already kind of divided, so that when the chainsaw, like, Tom Hanks is standing off to the right of his family, his wife and his son, so that the chainsaw can come through and split them properly. But the picture itself even has already got that separation, which I just thought was a really nice touch. It's like anticipating the chainsaw.
It's a great sequence, and you're right, it's such a gateway, especially since he's watching the horror movies as he's going to bed, you know, he sees those scenes. And I think for us, and probably for a lot of younger guys our age, that was probably the first images of like really like R-rated horror movies that we were seeing was in this movie.
Yeah, I definitely mentioned too. Sorry, I was going to say, I had not seen Texas Chainsaw 2. I know that's, I maybe had seen The Exorcist, but I'm not sure, but definitely not TCM 2. So this would be the first time I would have seen it.
And I got to mention like the great, one thing I'll say about this, if I can just dive into the extras a little bit here, is that the great thing about this new Blu-ray is the work print. You get the full work print of the movie. Which is something that they put out on the Arrow Blu-ray over in the UK, and is, you know, they've taken now to put on this one. It's amazing to get to see this. I remember when the movie first came out on DVD, it had the alternative ending on it, which was huge, and it was amazing to see that. But this is an entire work print with deleted scenes and his temporary track, which is just to kind of get into his mind, the mind of Joe Dante, the filmmaker. Just watch this thing from beginning to end, you know. Despite the quality, it's just fascinating. And the dream sequence is interestingly affected because Kevin McCarthy gets a role in it. He gets a shot in the movie.
And he's the boss,
what I
right?
noticed this time, he plays the boss, because there was originally going to be a subplot that I think was suggested by Tom Hanks, where Ray's actually lost his job and he doesn't want to tell his family about it. He's embarrassed. And then it kind of comes, you know, that he finally does admit at the end of the movie. So Joe Dante called Kevin McCarthy in to play the boss just in this dream sequence. It wasn't going to take it out of the neighborhood or anything, but just to appear. Watching it this time, I realized he looks like James Caron from Poltergeist.
Wow.
In this suit, the way he's looking, which is perfect because the dream sequence itself is a three-fold Tobe Hooper tribute. First, he's watching TCM2. And then Dante apes at the very beginning of the dream, the opening shot from Poltergeist, the snow on the TV panning over to the bed. And then when he wakes up, Mr. Rogers is on TV, just like in Poltergeist.
Wow.
So me thinking he looks like Karen is like, I don't think I'm just throwing it out there. I think maybe that was intentional.
No, I think you're right. And it just occurred to me that it's not exactly going to line up as much as the other things you're talking about, but that whole Carrie Fisher at the top of the staircase dreamy thing reminds me a little bit of the staircase in Poltergeist.
The huge staircase, yes, from Poltergeist.
Wow.
Totally.
That's interesting. That's
especially interesting. In the work print version where you see a lot more of the staircase, because in the final film, you just see her at the top of the landing.
Yeah.
But in the dream sequence, which is hugely different in the work print, yeah, you see like the whole thing and it's gigantic. And she's at the top of it. So, oh, man.
What are some of the other standout bits in the... I didn't get a chance to go through the whole work print, which I need to do. So do you have any highlights from that? Like the dream sequence is extended?
Of the deleted sequences, that's definitely the coolest thing, because not only is McCarthy in there, but Bruce Dern and Wendy Schall pop up in the dream sequence. I can't say I prefer it over the finished one. I think the finished one is better, although there is a nice little moment where a jail cell bars fall in front of Ray when he's in the house, and that transitions to him being on the grill, because the bars of the jail transition to him being on top of the grill, which is kind of nice. But you don't get Dick Miller with Walter in the trash can, so there's a lot of stuff
one of my favorite bits.
Right, you wouldn't want to lose that with Queenie with the little axe in her head.
So great.
So there's a lot of really cool little small... The other moments are kind of smaller, kind of like little character moments that are added in that don't add too much to it. But like I said before, just seeing how Dante was thinking before he hired Goldsmith to do his score, and seeing all the temp tracks that he put on to give it the tone that he wanted. It's a lot of Morricone. And of course, he ended up just using the one Morricone, Se Se Quel Condo e Colpa Mia from My Name is Nobody, when they walk up to finally knock on the door. Right before the bees happen, you know, that's just straight from Morricone, because I guess Goldsmith couldn't come up with something that was what Dante wanted for that. But so that's just fascinating to see that stuff in there.
That was new to me, that I didn't realize that because of the way that Goldsmith mixes it up so deftly in the movie, like he has bits of like a Patton like thing for Dern's character, and he has just different motifs throughout the whole movie. So I never even thought, I was like, whoa, he's doing a great Morricone imitation here. I did not realize that that was actually a track from My Name is Nobody until this revelation on this disc, which now watching it, I'm like, oh yeah, I hear that guitar harmonica thing that he's talking about that Morricone could do so well that I guess Jerry couldn't get. But man, until then, I didn't realize it. I was just like, what a spot on knockoff that was.
Right? How'd he get it to sound exactly right?
That's great.
One thing, unfortunately, that's missing from the new Blu-ray, which I would just say for completist, people who love the Burbs, you should get the Arrow if you don't have it, the Arrow release from the UK. Is Dante commentary on a side-by-side comparison to the deleted scenes from the work print and the finished film.
Nice.
The feature is called A Tale of Two Burbs on there. Not a great title, but since Dante hasn't recorded a full commentary for the movie, this is, I think, is the closest you'll get to him talking scene-specific about a lot of stuff, like which Bela Lugosi movie is on TV at Walter's house. It's Shadows in Chinatown.
Oh, love it.
And you get those little tidbits that you love from like a regular Dante commentary. And that's one thing that I think, if you know you love the Burbs, this is a reason to get both Blu-rays, all the Blu-rays, everything that's out there.
I'm keeping my Arrow. That was something I definitely wanted to talk about. But let's move into the special features in a second. I know it's hard not to talk about them, but I'm going to lose all my love notes before I forget. Here's the thing. So, and I'm sure you feel the same way, and I think, I can't remember if we talked, I don't know if it came up on the matinee episode, but I miss the old comedic Tom Hanks. And I think this is one of the last great comedic performances that he gave, and he absolutely kills it. And I will say that, I mean, even from... you know, something as simple as him like running into a screen door and overreacting wildly is just simply glorious to me. But I do think that Rick Dukeman, who steals most every scene that he's in, is part of the reason that Hanks is okay, I don't want to make it sound like Dukeman is the reason Hanks is as good as he is, but I'm sure that Hanks had to up his game a little bit because Dukeman is so good. So I think that helped.
He's perfect.
Yeah, I mean, he is the guy. And I've got a short story about this that is interesting in retrospect after having gone through these extras and hearing it hinted at a few times in the different interviews and whatnot that Hanks and Dukeman did not necessarily get along on the set.
Why don't you go say hi?
Well, yeah, I guess I could.
You know, this would be the perfect time because you could go up and talk to him. We could see what he's like. You know. Go.
You could go say hi to him, too, you know.
Yeah, but he's your neighbor.
Well, no, he's your neighbor as well.
No, but I'm over. You share a property line with him. He's
yeah,
your, like,
we're all on the same block, so, I mean, you could go, too. So.
No, we're all in the same town, too, but you're right next to him. If he's ever going to borrow anything, he'd come over to your place.
Well, he's busy now.
Nice. No, he's not busy. Now, look, he's going into... Go now, because he's going back in. If you were going to say hi, you should probably... There, he's going into the... You're going to lose him, because he's going to go in... Well, there now, you've blown it, haven't you?
No, I didn't blow it. He went into his house.
Chicken?
I'm not chicken because he went into his house.
Well, he went into his... You know, you look like a chicken in front of your son and everything. Your son.
And I don't know if that was a... I mean, I would imagine maybe there was a sort of a comedic rivalry or who knows what it was. But Dukeman is as funny or funnier than Hanks in this movie. And I'm not saying he's a better actor, but in this movie, like, he's like... in the pocket perfectly, and there's no way that anybody's going to touch him because it's one of those movies where every once in a while an actor will have the absolute perfect role that no one else could play, and so you can't touch them, and that's basically what Dukeman is in this movie. So there could be, I imagine the rivalry could have stemmed from that.
Yeah, it's who knows what was going on with them. I'm sure they used it, you know, for the kind of contentious relationship between Art and Ray.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm sure it was probably helpful.
Totally works. But yeah, my story is that Tom Hanks came into the video store I was working at circa 2000, and everybody flipped out. There was like two people in the store, so there wasn't like much to distract. I checked him out. I got him to sign my Burbs DVD. I think he wrote party with an exclamation point on it, but I'm not exactly sure what it says. But what I did say to him was I'd actually weirdly written like an Amazon review of the Burbs like two or three nights earlier. And I mentioned it to him and I just said, which is such a stupid thing to say to him, like, who the fuck cares? Anyway, but then I was like, I just love, you know, you and Rick Dukeman in that movie. And he said something like, ah, yes, the amazing Rick Dukeman. And now in my head, I just roll it over and over in my, and I wonder if that was a case where he's like, that fucking guy, I can't shake that fucking guy, you know, like years
yeah,
later.
Yeah, but it spiked it a little bit, huh?
Yeah, it was weird. Like, I wonder now if he was just like, I like that you're a fan of the Burbs, but why'd you have to bring up fucking Dukeman? He seems like actually one of the sweetest humans in the interviews, and he was genuinely a total sweetheart to us at the store. And so it probably wasn't that. But in my head now, I'm like, wow, I wonder if that rubbed him the wrong way the one time that I met him.
That's a great story. Yeah, and that definitely explains a lot, I think, finding out that they had this... not great relationship. I have to bring up that, do you know the movie Making the Grade?
I do. I love Making the Grade.
He's a millionaire. He's a playboy.
How about a brewski? Nice grab.
He's a fun-loving guy. He's Palmer Woodrow III.
Gosh! Darn it!
And he's going to lose his inheritance.
You will actually have to get a job.
Unless... he graduates from Hoover Prep.
Hey, you know something? Nobody at that school knows what I look like. Pay some guy what? $500-$600 a month and a bonus to graduate?
Where do you propose to find the idiot to do this?
Yeah, so you know Dana Olsen, the
yes.
writer of the Burbs, plays a character in that. I have to bring up my...
Palmer Woodrow, I think, is his name.
Right, yes.
I love that name for some reason.
My friend Kevin Marr theorized that Dane Olson must have written Art Weingartner for himself.
Ah.
Because he's so similar to that to kind Paul of a character that he yeah. plays in Making the Grade, which I think is the only movie he acted in a major role. And when he told me that, I immediately went to the Dane Olson commentary, which is the only full-length commentary track on the Blu-ray. And unfortunately, there's no, he doesn't shed any light on that. He doesn't mention writing the part for himself or anything like that. He only mentions that at the time everyone was writing for Bill Murray.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Kevin might be on the mark with that. I feel like if you go and watch Making the Grade, which I'm a fan of, definitely, I think that's a fun movie that is a little lost to time at this point, but a very fun Judd Nelson vehicle, and I love Dana's performance as Palmer Woodrow, the guy that basically Judd Nelson is pretending to be for the year or whatever, semester, I don't remember. I think he's really great in that little part. So I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Who knows? I mean, who knows if he was even still interested in acting at that point, or if he was just kind of a full-time writer. I know he was like doing TV stuff and everything. So he might've just given up acting entirely, but you can definitely feel him in that role. You know, yeah. you can definitely feel it in the writing. And, I know that they say a lot that on the documentaries that it was filmed during a writer's strike. So there was a whole lot of improvising on set. And, you know, once they say that, you can kind of like, you can kind of pinpoint a few lines that feel like, oh, that definitely was a Bruce Dern improv, you know, and things like that.
Hey, Pinocchio. And
yeah. And like yeah.
That. I actually met
lots of lines.
Sorry. I was gonna say, I actually met Courtney Gaines at a restaurant about 4 months ago. It was not that long ago. And I spent the entirety of the dinner. We were in a restaurant that had a sort of patio area that was glassed off. And he was sitting with some people on the other side of the glass, the next table across the way from us through the glass. And I spent almost the entire dinner going like, oh, should I go and say something to him? And my buddy, who is also actually worked in the video store, I don't know if he was working the day that Tom Hanks came in or not. This is a friend of mine that I've been friends with for almost 20 years. He was like, dude, you got to go talk to him. So I finally went over and said something and, you know, said how much I loved him in The Burbs, and which clearly is a thing. He also has, as with Joe Dante, it's his number two, Children of the Corn, and then The Burbs are apparently the movies he gets approached about the most. But he was super sweet as well, and I got a picture with him. Just a, you know, really couldn't have been nicer. But I just need to meet more members of the Burbs cast. I've met Corey Feldman. Corey Feldman was at my house once for an arcade game night. We did not talk about The Burbs, but I won't. I'll tell you something off mic about that. It doesn't have to do with him, actually. It has to do with his nanny that was there watching his kid, who also came along. But I need to meet Bruce Dern, because this movie was my introduction to Bruce Dern, and you couldn't have really a better introduction, I don't think, to what he is and what he can do to and what he can bring to a movie. And my favorite line in any movie forever was
about a 9 on the tension scale, Rube.
I mean, now it's everything he says, but that forever was like one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's funny, like, seeing him in this first and then being kind of disappointed when you see his more serious roles and thinking, why isn't he being funny? He's so funny in The Burbs. But yeah, I mean, yeah, he's just an incredible actor. It's always great to see him. I've, you know, said that he just, like, and again, just perfect casting for this part to make this amazing character a reality.
Rumsfeld's the name. Don't think I caught yours, Sonny. Hans. Hans. Oh, a fine Christian name. Hans Christian Andersen. What, are you Catholic?
I don't know.
Oh, pretty girl. Friend of yours?
No, it came with the frame.
It came with the frame?
Yes.
And then the last thing I'll say before we go into special features, this is a total throwaway, but last time we talked about Matinee, I think you brought up the point that people obviously give Tarantino a lot of credit for resurrecting careers and bringing back older actors, and that you, I think, were saying that Dante has been doing that for a long time and maybe could have influenced Tarantino in that way, or at least he was doing it before. And I noticed this is a really stupid, super nerdy thing, and you've probably picked up on it, but I didn't until this time. There's a bit where Tom Hanks is eating some cereal and it's called Freaky's cereal. Yes. And I looked it up, and that's a cereal from like 1972. So it's not a cereal I don't think was still around in 1989. I could be wrong. But I know that Tarantino revived some cereals like Fruit Brute for Pulp Fiction. And I know he's a big cereal breakfast guy, but I'm like, Dante doing it first. Just saying.
Another connection. Absolutely. And you see the Gremlin cereal box too in the background at one point in the Peterson house.
Good eye, man. Good eye.
And also Tarantino cast Bruce Dern in Hateful Eight, right?
Yeah. So absolutely, I'm sure he's a fan. Gotta be a fan.
Definitely. I will say the secret MVP of this movie is Carrie Fisher.
I think it's time that we all stopped acting like kindergartners. Don't you, Ray?
Yes, Carol.
Now, before somebody falls off a roof or sets themselves on fire, I think we should go over there, knock on their door, and invite ourselves in for a nice neighborly chat. Get to know these people like we should have done a month ago.
Everything she does in this movie cracks me up. I think she does an amazing job just like making the most out of like a background part for the most part, you know? Just the part where Ray accepts Ray's offered the pretzel and the sardine, and he looks over at her, and she gives him the encouraging little nod.
Oh my God,
splits me up.
Yes.
That's like one of my favorite parts of this movie. We talk about it all the time. But when she's walking to the bathroom, and she tells him, go into the bathroom, relax. Just some great stuff. One of the biggest revelations for me in the main documentary of this was Wendy Shaw revealing that Carrie Fisher wears a wig in this movie.
Never would have seen it. And I looked afterwards. I'm like, I still don't see it.
It looks like real hair. I went to my friend Kate Wilkinson, who's a wig expert. She has a great Tumblr called Wig Work. She says it looks like hair to me. I can't believe it's a wig.
Wow.
She did a whole like feature on it because she was so blown away. She called it a wig-piphany. She was so amazed.
That's awesome.
I never in a million years would have guessed that was
not
real hair.
And that's one of my favorite jokes and, you know, sort of evocative of the kind of person that she was that Wendy talks about, like, you know, there'd be times when a take would get blown or they'd have to go again. And Carrie kept saying, was it the wig? Which I just think is so funny. That's just so perfect. Yeah, she is great. I mean, a lesser actor, you know, disappears completely and you don't even know because she doesn't have a ton of dialogue. I do agree that the scene with the sardine is not as good if not for her little, because there's more than one shot of her like encouraging him to like first take the sardine and the pretzel and then eat the sardine and the pretzel. And it's all done with like gestures. And she is brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And the commentary, and I feel like the documentary, it comes up a few times. People are very curious if Tom Hanks ate the sardine and the pretzel. And it does appear that he at least gave a couple good chews on it.
Yeah, you could see it goes in there.
It's one take. Like, it goes in the mouth. There's chewing. I kept waiting for the cut. I'm like, okay, where's the cut? And clearly he could have just totally, you know, spit it out after. But he took a good couple bites on it and, you know, hats off. And somebody speculated, I think it was on the commentary, that I think Dana was saying, like, he didn't think they had, like, a prop sardine made out of bananas. Probably a real sardine. So,
oh yeah, it looks like a real sardine to me, not a stunt sardine at all.
Anyway, we can dive into these extras. So a lot of this stuff is coming over from the Arrow disc. The first one, which is great, is a hour and 6 minute documentary called There Goes the Neighborhood, which includes interviews with Dante, Corey Feldman, Wendy Shaw, Courtney Gaines, the director of photography, Robert M. Stevens, production designer, James H. Spencer. And I thought there was somebody else, but that might be it. Do you remember anybody else in there?
That's all I remember. Feldman's okay. Dante is perfect, by the way.
That is, he only does it once. And yeah, Joe has, I guess, like a slightly nasally voice that people seem to latch onto. I've heard a couple other people imitate him at some point, and I can't remember who. But yeah, Corey nails it. He really nails it. Because he's talking about like when he came in to audition, and he's like, Joe, I'm sorry, my hair's not normally like this. And then Corey goes into his Joe saying, no, it's great. It's exactly what I want. And I can't do it. I'm not even going to try. But he kills it.
He does. He nails it.
That's my favorite part of the whole Corey interview. I mean, I like his interview. I think hats off to him for participating in this. Although I think he is a little self-conscious about it, you know, and his place in it and where he was in his career. And I'm sure he's aware that other people on the set were aware of where he was at. And I'm guessing he's probably going in his head. He's probably going, what is everybody else saying about me in this documentary that I don't know about? And I also did notice how the shot of him seems slightly art directed in this way that, like, there's movie posters behind him, which is whatever, but his book choreography is oddly, like, tilted and placed facing the camera,
like on the fireplace behind
on the mantle. Yeah. I was like, okay, Corey, I know, that's fine. You want to plug it? That's great. But you could be a little more subtle, but whatever. That's neither here nor there. I'm glad he's in the doc. It's interesting to hear his thoughts, you know, for sure.
Yeah, I think two of my favorite Dante story from it is we were talking about shooting on the Universal lot and how they were so close to the Jaws attraction, so that like every 10 minutes or so you hear, I guess there's a victim going, help, help me, help me. And he claims you can hear it in the movie. I've never heard it.
No, we do.
That would be a nice little additional thing, like a Clopex victim in the background or something.
That's a good one. Do you have any other Joe stories you liked? I feel like he had some good things that he brought out, and I'm blanking on some of them.
I kind of want to shift over to the interview, the brand new Dante interview that was shot specifically for this release.
Yeah.
And kind of what that has to do. Some of my favorite bits from that. Everyone should watch it. I don't want to give away too much of it, but moments that I really like where he was talking about some of the famous comedians who really wanted to play Art. And that comes up a few times in the documentaries, that a lot of well-known comedians wanted to play that role. But he says, I didn't want to do an SCTV thing, which makes me think John Candy might have been like the one who was interested in it. And of course, you can see, you know, Hanks and Candy doing another movie together. You can see that kind of dynamic.
Splash and Volunteers reunion or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Plus, I think Dana Olson had written It Came from Hollywood, which had John Candy in it. So there was that connection as well. So that was just kind of like a hint that maybe that's what he was thinking of. I guess he said Bob Picardo introduced him to Wendy Shaw when they did the Amazing Stories episode together, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that's a great. I mean, he used her a ton after that. So hats off to Picardo, because she is great. I thought she was absolutely charming in the documentary, and I've been a fan of hers since this movie. Actually, since Innerspace, I guess. Yeah, she's just fantastic. She's really great.
Oh, love her. She's phenomenal. She's great as Phil Hartman's wife in Small Soldiers. Just can't say enough about her parts in Joe Dante's movies. I love how Dante said that. Henry Gibson was cast because of his role as the doctor from The Long Goodbye, as the creepy little doctor in that movie.
Are you looking for someone?
Yes.
No, I'm going to deliver this book.
To whom are you delivering the book?
Oh, the man who wrote it, Roger Wade.
But they told you at the office there's no one here by that name.
Are you Dr. Berenger?
Good morning, Dr. Berenger.
Yeah, they told me at the office you weren't here either.
Yeah, I have that in my notes too.
Connection before, yeah, but that's a great. That's like perfect. You know, that makes perfect sense. And he was considering Timothy Carey to play Rube before Timothy came in, but considered him too
notes.
Imposing, which is like, well, duh. Yeah, Tim Carey's a little imposing. I don't blame you. And I would love to see the alternative universe where that became a reality. Although, of course, I would much rather Brother Theodore play that part.
Yeah, no, it makes it a singular. I mean, I love Tim Carey. I think he's great, and I would love to see Bruce Dern and Tim Carey kind of going at it. That'd be great. Because Dern, I think, could hold his own against Timothy Carey. But yeah, I feel like Brother Theodore really makes it, I don't know, it just solidifies the Burbs universe, because Brother Theodore didn't do really that many other movies. I think he did like Nocturna maybe, and I don't know, I feel like maybe a couple others, but not a lot of movies. So if you...
He did Gums the Jaws porno.
Oh my god.
Okay, hipcats, get off my car.
You know,
get off my car.
Dude, you should hang out for a little bit. Chill out with us.
You
We've got the pizza going. Dude coming. You know,
imbecile, some more on you.
I just love it when an actor like him appears in one or two movies, and thus they imprint on you forever from that. And then of course they're amazing, like he is so good as Rube, and the fact that he's like hard of hearing, and apparently, you know, like Dante tells a story about how he had to cut a take with Carrie Fisher because she was actually shouting at Brother Theodore because he really couldn't hear his cues. That said, I think it all works. Like, the way that he speaks, especially to Dern. The other line that I love is when Dern's like, you know, I didn't see the moving van at all. And he's like,
I don't understand that. It was parked outside all day.
The way that he leans on all day is one of my favorite things ever. So, but anyway, yeah,
oh, every delivery is just, it's a freaking gift.
I would imagine that probably maybe has something to do with him being hard of hearing as well as, you know, a character thing. Who knows? But the combination of whatever it is makes for a singular performance unlike any other that I've basically ever seen. I just think it's so good. I love him so much.
Yeah, just amazing intuitive casting there, without a doubt.
Yeah, did you pull anything else out of the Joe Dante interview? Because, yeah, that's so funny. I had the Henry Gibson thing in my notes. I had the Tim Curry thing in my notes. And
I was surprised he talked to Georges Delerue about doing the score. That's freaking crazy. The new wave composer who worked with Truffaut and Godard and did Hiroshima Mon Amour.
Wow.
Doing the Burbs? That would have been really strange choice.
Wow. I totally missed that altogether. That's crazy.
Yeah. So that would have been very different, I
think. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's
imagine what that would have even been.
I can't either. I can't wrap my head around it at all. Yeah, I like that interview. I think there's a little crossover between the documentary and the interview in terms of some things that Joe repeats a little bit, but I thought it was a nice additional. It's about 18 minutes talking to Joe. That's great. And I like that they brought John Hora back, even though he's only additional photography, because he was shooting.
Wait, before you say it, because this cleared up something that I've always been curious about this movie. Why John Hora, who shot every other major Joe Dante movie during the big Dante era between Howling and Matinee, didn't shoot The Burbs. And I, before seeing this interview, had looked up his filmography, and I narrowed it down to it was either Moonwalker or Loverboy, right? And I was like, it has to be Moonwalker, right? Because it's like Michael Jackson's huge at the time. You can't walk away from that.
Yeah.
And then so finally listen to this interview. It was Loverboy all along. I couldn't believe it.
What does Randy Bodek have that women find so irresistible?
Extra anchovies.
Monica hates pizza.
Senior pizza. Just take your clothes off.
Take me.
Oh, five more calls. All extra anchovies.
He's probably some young Beach Boy stud.
Hey, there's a husband out there who wants to kill me.
Loverboy, he delivers.
My lip is caught in the zip line.
Rated PG-13. Starts Friday at a theater near you.
Dude, you know what was funny is that, and I don't know why I didn't know this or I didn't remember it, Joan Micklin-Silver directed Loverboy. Holy shit. Right. I did not realize that. So when he mentioned that he was shooting Loverboy for Joan Micklin-Silver, I was like, wait a minute. There's a lot I need to unpack from that. But yeah, I really have come to like John Hora a lot. Like the first, the Matinee one, I'm sure it's the same, you know, session of interviews. They probably shot him for Matinee and for The Burbs at the same time. But with the Matinee one, I was like, oh, he seems like kind of a lovable old crank, you know, like kind of a grouchy kind of dude but like obviously a really great DP and a guy whose work I really appreciate. But in this one, he seemed, I think partially because, I don't know, maybe it was because it's not his movie. He was a little more relaxed about it or didn't have as much to complain about. Not to say he was complaining that much in the other interview, but I got a sense that he was holding back slightly on a few things with Matinee that were problematic that he still remembered and that bothered him. But in this one, you know, it was different. He was just a little more loose, and I just like him. I just like him a lot. I just think he's fun to listen to.
Yeah, I got that too. He did seem more relaxed on this particular interview. It was fun that he mentioned Bruce Dern talking to him about his high school because he's a huge track fan, and that's the exact same thing that Wendy Shaw mentions on the documentary. I guess Bruce Dern just really loves track.
Yeah, high school track. That's hilarious. Yeah, also in my notes is the fact that both of them, because Wendy Shaw seems so confused by that question, the first thing she said that he said to her was, "Where'd you go to high school?" And he's like, she was like, "Why would I haven't been asked that since I was in high school? I don't." But it turned out he just was obsessed with high school track, apparently. And and when she told him where she went, he like gave her some facts about that track team. I don't know what. I think that's such an interesting thing. The idea of, I just pictured Bruce Dern going to like random high school track meets.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
bizarre.
So strange, but not out of character. Ultimately, I was like, yeah, I guess that kind of makes sense. You know.
No, I can see it. I was trying to figure out exactly what John Horris shot, you know. It seems like mainly he was responsible for reshoots of the ending, like the insurance of the skulls and the trunk and whatnot. Although, I don't know, because they reshot the dream sequence, I feel like that scene is so him, you know. Yeah. It's the way Carrie Fisher is shot on those stairs reminds me of like the way he shot the female gremlin in Gremlins 2, you know. Like, it has a very horror feel to it. So he doesn't mention it specifically, but I'd be curious to know if he came in to do a few reshoots on that as well. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think you're totally right. Yeah, it's hard to get a sense because, I mean, it sounded like I can't remember if the strike ended before they were done shooting, and so then they had some rewrites at the last minute that sort of amped up a little bit of the action at the end of the movie, like, you know, I feel like a car crashes into a house and some other stuff, and I wasn't sure if he was saying that he shot some of that stuff, or like you said, if it's just the insert stuff. I couldn't tell. That was one thing I wish he had said, like you mentioned, but other than that, I thought that was really neat. The interview with Marshall Harvey was interesting, although I got more out of the other two interviews, I think, than that one. But that's new as well.
Yeah, I like how he mentioned specifically that Ducommun's big speech about "we're out to get them," you know, at the end of the movie was improvised.
I think the message to psychos, fanatics, murderers, nutcases all over the world is do not mess with suburbanites, because frankly, we're just not going to take it anymore. You know, we're not going to be content to look after our lawns and wax our cars, paint our houses. We're out to get them, Don. We are out to get them.
Yes.
That they had shot that in the original ending, and he specifically said to them, "I hope you have him when you reshoot that. Make sure he does that speech again, because it's great."
Yeah, and it's funny because if you watch the alternate ending, there's a slight different, like, Dukeman's talking to a newspaper reporter as opposed to a TV reporter, I want to say, and he has a slightly different spin on the speech. So I feel like either that's the first version of the speech that's not quite as developed, and then the final version, he adds a few things. Like, he says, you know, "We're not going to just be content to mow our lawns," and blah, blah, blah. I feel like he only has one thing that he says in the alt version, and then I feel like he expanded it out in the best possible way for the actual ending, which is great, because that speech is perfect. Like, everything he does is, I just love that.
Yeah, that would be like a nice little benefit to doing the reshoots, is that he maybe thought about it a little bit more and was able to refine it to how we know it today. So
yeah, RIP, yeah. He is missed, and I wish he had been given some more opportunities to do stuff like this. I mean, every movie he ever showed up in, like, you know, I don't know if we talked about it, maybe we did in the last one, but like, it, you know, the guy who's on the electrician or whatever in Die Hard, you know, that's like shut down grid 212. And then, you know, the guy whose pool, I want to say Bruce Willis crashes his car into Rick Dukeman's pool in The Last Boy Scout.
And Hunt for October, I think he pops up in.
Oh, does he really? Oh, I forgot about that.
I think so, yeah. And then, of course, in Gremlins 2, having a little cameo in there.
And Blank Check with Brian Bonsall from Family Ties. I want to say he's got actually a pretty decent-sized role in Blank Check, but I haven't seen
Blank Check. Yeah, he's also hilarious as Anna Faris's father in the first Scary Movie.
"What's going on in there? Oh, Daddy's head is stuck. Unstick Daddy's head.
Dad, can you knock?
Knock? I thought I heard screaming in here.
No, you didn't, Dad.
Well, it could have been that crack I smoked earlier, I guess.
Yeah,
that's what it was. Listen, I gotta leave town for a couple days, okay? No big deal. Just, you know, that new business that I started with those Colombian guys?
Oh, you mean Uncle Escobar?
Yeah, that's right. Well, there's a problem. Some money went missing, and apparently some legs are gonna get broken. It's just better if I lay low for a couple days.
Okay.
Now, if the cops raid the place...
I never heard of you.
And don't forget...
to flush your stash.
Oh, you are my little girl. I love you so much that I left you a little something in the coffee can.
Dad.
But you have to remember to step on it before you sell it. Now, what are you going to cut it with?
Baking...
Baking soda, not baking powder. Because baking powder guys will have muffins growing out of their nose.
Yeah.
You love that joke, don't you, honey? You've loved that joke since you were 2 years old. Okay, well...
Okay, I love you.
I love you.
Oh my God, that I totally forgot about.
Yeah, yeah, he's really funny. He's really funny in that movie. And I remember that was one of the things that like immediately pulled me over to that film, seeing him early in the movie, being like, oh my God.
All right, so they're obviously Burbs fans. That's great. The Duke. So what else did you dig from these extras? I mean, the documentary is great. I feel like we've sort of bounced around on it, but yeah, there's a lot of neat stories. I thought Courtney Gaines was really fun and animated in the interview and seems to make some interesting points about the movie when it came out and, you know, sort of where he was at his career and how Bruce Dern pulled him aside and gave him some advice. And he just seems genuinely affectionate about the movie and where what it meant to him and what it still means to him as far as, you know, his career and recognizability and whatnot.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think he seems like a really cool, laid back guy who definitely appreciated, you know, the kind of chance to work with these big actors and have this kind of be his movie in like a moment that really kind of touches me, you know, just speaking about Rick Ducommun and, you know, the actors that we wish we could meet from this fantastic movie. You know, he brings up that he's the last surviving Klopek, you know, that unfortunately Henry Gibson and Brother Theodore are no longer around. And it's a real, like, you know, brings a tear to your eye sort of moment to think about that. Like, oh yeah, he is the last of the those crazy guys. And Carrie Fisher too. It's just a bummer that so many of them have passed away in the last 10 years or so. It's a bummer, but he's great. I really like the Dana Olsen commentary, even though he's not a Burbs expert.
Definitely not.
He probably hasn't watched the movie in quite some time and doesn't really have too many memories, but he does talk about how the neighbors digging in the middle of the night in the rain actually happened to him in his neighborhood.
Yeah.
And so that's something that he put into the script. So that's fun to listen to. I always enjoy that. And since we don't have a full Dante commentary, you know, that's the next best thing was, you know, have him come in here and, you know, he's got an expert to talk to him and kind of point out some good stuff as well. Anything that he probably would have missed sitting there getting things confused between the Burbs and Laverne and Shirley, you know? So, But what really struck me, kind of the connective tissue between all these things and kind of asking, like, why did this not work? Why do people still – are they still suspect about why people love this movie? They bring up the ending so many times and, like, what was the correct ending? Because I guess the original ending of the script was that Ray goes into the ambulance and it pulls away and the implication is that he's their next victim, you know, that and it has a bleak – that ends on that bleak moment. Which obviously wasn't going to work.
Yeah.
But this, because the whole movie sets up this idea, this kind of message about, like, you know, people who create their own monsters, you know, people, it's like a monsters or do a Maple Street sort of thing where you just suspect your next door neighbor of these heinous acts or because they're slightly odd or eccentric, they must be evil. Like, I feel that all the time personally, you know, just like I've like had a tree stump pulled up in my front yard recently. So there's just all this mulch all over it. And I haven't cleaned it all up yet. And I'm always nervous now that people are going to think, like, God, what an asshole. Like, my neighbors are going to hate me because my yard looks like trash. And that sentiment, I think, you feel that in this movie. And it comes up in lines, you know, when Wendy Shaw says, you know, we shouldn't be staring like this. And even Rumsfeld's, like, opinion towards the Klopeks, where he calls them foreigners and
Klopek. What is that, Slavic?
No.
Or even how he suspects that Queenie has been trained by Walter to crap in his yard. But there's that double thing of like, but he's right, you know? So the problem that this sets up for the ending, obviously, is that the Klopek should clearly not be monsters. It clearly should have ended with Ray's speech saying, it's not them, it's us. You know, that big climatic speech. But that's not satisfying for an audience at all.
Yeah.
And like I would compare it to like two Hitchcock movies, Rear Window, which was obviously like a template going into this movie that was going to be called Bay Window, was going to be like a parody, like a comedy version of Rear Window. Of course, Raymond Burr has to be guilty. You know, he has to at the end. They can't just be being paranoid, even though the whole movie builds on this idea of like voyeurism and, you know, being creepy stalker and like imagining these things when you're confined to your own space. But you can't have Raymond Burr not be the bad guy. And then you compare that to Suspicion, which wusses out at the end. And he goes, Cary Grant is not the bad guy.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work. And it's like this dry fart where it's just like, it doesn't, it's just a quiff of an ending where it's just like, oh, that was terrible. So I think they're kind of painting themselves in a corner. Well, of course, they had to have this epic ending where it's the Klopex, but even Joe Dante seems embarrassed that they open the trunk and it's a bunch of skulls. And he's like, so I guess they like skulls. I don't know. Well, like, they couldn't actually come out and say what was going on in that basement, what they were doing, but just like say, yeah, you were right. They were bad guys all along.
Yeah, no, it is tricky because it's a bummer. You want this movie that's like means a lot to us. There's a part of me that wants it to be this indictment of, you know, that sort of judgmental behavior or what have you, and have sort of an overarching message that sort of underwrites all the comedy instead of letting everybody off the hook by making it be the case. But you're totally right. I mean, it really doesn't satisfy in the same way. And man, I love Henry Gibson's reaction at the end when they catch him in the ambulance. And he's just kind of like, know, what you going to do?
He has that exact same facial expression, both in the original ending and in the final one, where it's like, whoops, you know?
Yeah, it's a great whoops, yeah.
It's awesome. Yeah, no, he totally plays it. And like, after saying all that, I want to just say like, that, and it's like, I want to say to everyone involved who brings this up as a problem, it's okay. It works.
Yes.
It works. I love it. I think you guys did it perfectly. I think that, you know, we kind of get the best of both worlds. We get Ray's speech, but we also have the satisfaction of knowing that the Klopex actually were up to something. You know, like,
yeah,
it works thematically and narratively. Like, I think that those things can exist. And I think if you had a less talented director, obviously that would be a problem. But Joe Dante, I think, it does it as a great balancing act. So, and it's funny and it's exciting, that final ambulance chase and the pizza dude crash, and, you know, like, that stuff is fun. So that ending works as a fun ending, and also one that, you know, you go back and you watch this movie and it makes you think, you know, in ways that you wouldn't have expected. So absolutely. Because it gets brought up by Dante, it gets brought up by John Hora, who, you know, I think is the one who says, they're skulls. I don't know why there were skulls there. And at one point they say it was supposed to be the two garbage men in the trunk. It was supposed to be Dick Miller and Robert Picardo. But John Hora suggests that they're actually alive in the trunk. That they were just trapped in there, and they open the trunk and they get out. You know?
Which is funny, too. Definitely not dead. I can't have those guys be dead. That wouldn't work for me.
No, that would be terrible.
Yes, because I love them so much. But yeah, no, that's an interesting one. And then wasn't there something else, like cheerleaders, Joe said, were in the back at one point? Because there had been some cheerleader abductions or something around that time, which I don't remember, but I guess. It's funny how all these things come together and add to this alchemy, which ends up making, to me, one of the great comedies of the 1980s. Whether it was planned to be that way or not, it doesn't matter now, because I feel like we have what we have, you know, and I love what we have, you know.
Me too. So, I mean, I've read interviews too where Dante's embarrassed by the smash zoom, and it's like, you just want to like be like, Joe, we love that.
Yeah,
that is one of the greatest moments in movie history, with the femur bone. It's so funny.
Yeah, that's too bad he's embarrassed about it, because I just feel like if anybody has earned the right to do that joke, it's a guy who's as cinematically well-versed as Joe Dante, you know, who would almost think it's too easy and just totally pandering. But ultimately, I don't think it is that. I think it's a great joke in the context of the movie, and I think it just gives a little extra something on top of this already heightened fantasy universe that he's created. And I think it's just a great little bit.
Yeah. It's that Dante formula where it can be, you know, have that fun, dark B movie resonance, but also be fun and funny, you know? So I appreciate the hell out of that.
Me too. Me too. Well, I think that's about it for this. You know what I never mentioned is that we are talking about, of course, the Shout Select Collector's Edition of The Burbs. I don't think I explicitly said that. It'll be in the title of the episode, but definitely worth a pickup for those fans of this movie. I'm really glad that it's available in the States now, because I feel like a lot of people were not, you know, taking the plunge with the Arrow version, which obviously you're getting a lot of the stuff, and I appreciate you telling me about the commentaries, the select scenes sort of comparison, I'll be keeping my arrow. But this is great for folks in the States. Definitely done with some care and a nice tribute to a movie that we both love. So I think we'd both say definitely pick it up, right?
Oh, absolutely. And speaking of Arrow, March 20th was like my birthday this year, because this got released and then Robert Altman's Images got released by Arrow the same day. So that was a nice mail day.
Oh my gosh. I should do a show about Images maybe, but that was definitely a highlight for me, and a movie that I've been wanting to have. I mean, I've had it on DVD for years, but to have a nice special edition like that Arrow disc was unexpected and wonderful. So I'm with you 100%. What a great day.
Absolutely. The DVD is badly cropped, so it was really great to get that really nice Blu-ray out, for sure.
Oh, I did not even know that. Oh, my gosh. Wow. Yeah. So was it 2.35 and they cropped it to 1.85 or something? Or
I think it was something like that. It's definitely squished in a way that it shouldn't be.
Holy smokes. That's good to know.
So great to just throw that new disc in and just see it the way it's supposed to be seen. So
yeah, definitely. I would say that'd be an interesting double feature. I don't know if it quite works, but the Burbs and Images coming out as close as they did is just as much a reason as any to pick up both and watch them close together if you haven't. But thank you, John, so much for coming back. You are my Dante guy, and maybe we'll get, I don't know how many more special editions of his films they can do, but if they do any more, I'd definitely love to have you back to talk about it.
I would love to. I hope they get Gremlins 2 special edition out there sometime. I would love that.
Me too, man.
Extra stuff. Me too. And I will I bet you got a bunch of guys lined up on May 22nd, Brian, but I would love to just throw my name in the hat for Shout Factory's release of Unknown Origin.
Yeah, man. Let's put that on the books. I'd love to talk about
that movie. I would love to talk about it. I'm very excited for that release as well. Shout Factory is just having a great year so far.
There's nobody that's reserved that one yet. So I'm putting you on the list.
Greatest
killer
rat movie ever made. I can't believe it.
I love it. I mean, I'm torn between that and Deadly Eyes, but I love both of them dearly. And I know Panos Cosmatos, it's his favorite of his dad's films. So that's a whole other level of praise that I think is kind of neat. Yeah, no, let's talk about that in May when that comes out. I can't wait for that disc. I'm psyched. Awesome. But thank you, sir. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Enjoy some Joe Dante very soon. And have a lovely and Blu-ray filled week. All right. Bye-bye.